Case 13 from The Gateless Barrier. Doksan holds his bowls. One day, Doksan went down toward the dining room holding his bowls. Seppo met him and asked, "Where are you off to with your bowls?" "The bell has not rung and the drum has not sounded." Doksan turned and went back to his room. Seppo mentioned this to Ganto, who remarked, "Doksan is renowned, but he does not know the last word." Doksan heard about this remark and sent his attendant to fetch Ganto. "You do not approve of me?" he asked. Ganto whispered his meaning. Doksan said nothing at the time, but the next day he ascended the rostrum, and behold, he was very different from usual. Ganto, going toward the front of the hall, clapped his hands and laughed loudly, saying, "Congratulations, our old man has got hold of the last word. From now on, nobody in this whole country can outdo him." Mumon's comment: as for the last word, neither Ganto nor Doksan ever dreamed of it. When you look into the matter, you find they are like puppets on the shelf. Mumon's verse: if you realize the first, you master the last. The first and the last are not one word. So our sixth day of training together, and we hold the fort. Some people have left, but still a wonderful atmosphere, and we hold this place of practice, this wonderful seat, this wonderful dojo, this place of no coming and going, no inside or outside, in which we meet ourselves in so many, many forms, meet ourselves in the form of the subject, and meet ourselves in the form of the so-called object. Clearly, I think it's clear to all of us by now that host and guest are making relationship, are in a relationship. This practice or self-study in the School of Quiet Illumination, again, always we use these words, school or line or lineage, in a provisional way, not in a sectarian way, just different ways, I think different ways of appreciating one thing, one this one great matter of life and death. So when I say soto or quiet illumination, the practice of great faith and great trust that your experience is the experience of the Dharma or of a Buddha. I don't mean that this way of appreciation is contradictory or opposed to the so-called Rinzai way or Linchi school, the school of a dynamic school, a dynamic school of action and doubt, sometimes called General Zen or Martial Zen. Quiet illumination, often called farmers, Zen, not in a derogatory way, but in terms of appreciating and cultivating life in all of its manifestations. So just two ways of, clearly two ways of talking about the same thing. It's a great, great challenge to take up this self-study and to be curious about what it is that's going on, and to question or to doubt or to inquire into it. And I think for all of us, while there are certain aspects of our experience that are familiar and easy to be with, both on the fulfillment side and on the active participation and loss side, there are also aspects of life and experience that we are, that are outside our realm of experience or consciousness. We don't know that we don't know them. And they are outside our realm. And when we come to the edge of these new worlds or new domains, new samadhis, you might say, new realms. In our experience, there is a certain ambivalence, clearly, and a certain edginess and squirreliness that we experience. And we are called upon in our study to enter into more and more and more of life and to find our home or our seat, or as Suzuki Roshi said, our a place of ease in the midst of our experience. We are called upon to explore, to be explorers, secret agents in a way in our own life, entering more and more deeply into it and testifying to the same truth over and over again in more and more realms of our experience. And this is both, as you know, both a joyous thing and a fearsome thing. A fearsome thing and a joyous thing. So the way of trust or faith is actually a complementarity to the way of inquiry or curiosity and doubt. We all want to trust that the activity of the moment is the enlightened world, and that the activity of the world is perfectly complete and radiant just as it is. And yet our experience tells us, not in an intellectual way, but deep in the marrow of our bones, in the deep recesses of our, that is, before our conscious control or manipulation, is not the case. Actually, I think that this not the case, is actually from the perspective of practice, the body cringe, or that this is no place to go, is actually a wonderful thing, because in order to enter these places, we cannot go with our, we cannot go with the known qualities that we have. If we went with the known qualities, we would only find replication of them in some shape or form. So we are called in our practice to be quite daring and extremely loving and quite courageous, to be willing to enter into those places that we are suspect or are convinced, or we have swerved when we approach those atmospheres. The spaceship has swerved off without, so convinced is it, it swerves off from those places with its radar, with its extremely sensitive radar, so much so that we don't know that there is a world, a galaxy, a solar system, a star abiding, a world system abiding in space. It's completely hidden from our view. And I think oftentimes when we get close to it, there is a shuddering of the spaceship. You know, it starts to shake and heat. And in order to pass through, something is required of us. In other words, we are required to do what we don't know how to do. And that's a wonderful, the most wonderful thing, because what it asks of us, what the Dharma asks of us, is that we are innocent and creative when the stakes are quite high, that we are creative. In other words, in order to genuinely find handhold on a sheer cliff of ice or a sheer wall of iron, that is where you can't feel any way, possible way of getting your finger in or getting a toehold into it, we are asked to be truly creative. It's a wonderful thing, and we don't know how to do that. In other words, as Suzuki Roshi used to tell us, admonish us in the early days, he said, we can do what we don't know how to do. And that not knowing how to do what we must do in order to take the next step of our lives, to enact, we often say that Zen practice has three bodies, and each body of experience, or bodies of love, we could say, or love and understanding. And each one contains within the other, within itself, the other two. So we are encouraged by our elders and by our worthies to, one, slow down and come to a dynamic stillness. which we call the Dharmakaya body. This is not, as David was saying in his lovely talk, this is not a static, frozen, fixated, numb, or dull place, but it is a alive, a resonant, a beautiful place. In Zen we say, the color of the mountain is her pure body. The stream in the valley is her broad tongue. I think this gives us some intimation that what we're working with is not a calisthenic or an objective kind of looking at things as if they were behind the glass of a museum, but an entering into the moment with all of our senses and all of our love and all of our intelligence working, at least at times, and being able to experience, to do something that we know how to do innately, but we don't know how to do because, well, we've lost sight and it has been occluded, not just in a visual way, but in our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body, our mind, our capacity for these three streams to flow as one stream. So anyway, we in this inquiry, in this self-fulfilling samadhi, we are called upon to do something that we don't know how to do, and somehow we find a way if we stay with it. And that which was once a wall, something slippery and opaque and impossible, becomes, there is a crevice in it. And that crevice is a crevice that is life-fulfilling. I remember some years ago we used to do these 2-week-long, actually there were 2 7-day sesshin, but some people stayed, so there were 2-week sesshin in the wilderness in New Mexico at the Vallecitos Mountain Refuge. It was a 100-acre ranch that a friend of mine from, old friend from Brown had somehow got a hold of to make as a Dharma center and a place of refreshment for, specifically for people who did inner city work and activists who did social activists and environmentalists who, because they are out on the outer edge of a certain kind of work where they have a dream and a vision and a love and something that they care profoundly about, but they are confronted by a great torrent of vulgarity in their work. Oftentimes we talk about, well, we have to embrace samsara and nirvana as one and not prefer one over the other, and in one sense it's true, and in another sense so much of life is so violent and vulgar that we need refreshment. We really do, so we come to retreat, or in this case, Grove, being an environmental lawyer, created this sanctuary, and we hold retreats for, they were allegedly for special interest groups, but they were just open. But so I had the wonderful opportunity while I was there to explore different wilderness areas and remember what, tracing one a stream. This ranch was in the middle of hundreds of the Carson National Forest, which is a vast, wonderful holding, while it's being used by the cattle herders, so the locusts are sort of devouring it in one sense, but still it's protected, it's quite beautiful. And I followed this, I remember, on a long, long walk, we had a day to explore in between the two sessions, following this stream upstream. Following this wonderful, you know, pristine mountain stream upstream, farther up into the rocks and into the mountains, until I came to a sheer cliff and looked like the stream disappeared into the solid rock. But on closer inspection, well, I could see that the solid rock wasn't as solid as it looked, and it had certain pores and crevices and cracks in it, out of which gurgled this wonderful, clear water. So we are called upon to sometimes to feel our way and to look for something. And when we find our way into the center of it. Or in Zen we say to face the wall. Our practice is sometimes called wall gazing in this collection of koan called the Mumonkan, called the gateless barrier. Of course, from one perspective, there is no barrier whatsoever. And from another perspective, the barrier is you, and the barrier is me. And this me that is the barrier is also the wall that is me, that separates me from my world, this husk that I spend time inside of. And I don't mean that in a judgmental way, more in a discerning way. Of course, discernment is very close to judgment, but it's different. We do need boundaries and protections from this world, and I suppose our, in one sense, our defenses and our boundaries are protecting the soft tissue of us, and they're a good thing. But we can discern that actually discernment and judgment is different. So we call this practice wall gazing, because we come up against the wall of ourself. And that wall of our self is, while on the one hand it is the most obvious, the elusive obvious, and the most thing that we are so familiar with that we think we know it, and it's so familiar that it becomes invisible, and yet it is a shell inside of which that we dwell, and the shell flattens our world and makes it boring, and makes us feel anxious and alone in our world. And clearly we all have experienced having sat with people and having had moments of wonderful intimacy with each one of you, where we intertwingle with one another and we inform each other in multiple dimensions that are quite unspeakable in a way. All the aspects of human life can inform one another, then it's, we know that there are times when it dissolves, but we say Mumonkan, the gateless barrier, because there is no barrier, but there is a barrier, and the barrier is the self, the I am self. The wonderful thing, I think, about Zen practice is that it is a profoundly inclusive practice, and the more that we practice, even though our rascally miserable selves are such a problem for us, they also are our food and our gate of realization. Dharma gates are countless. I pass through each and every one and find that originally there was no barrier. First there was a mountain, then there wasn't, then there was. You know that in our... So anyway, the gateless barrier and the Mumon Khan and this, we find ourselves asked to be creative in our practice, and also not assume that because something is familiar that we are intimate with it. They are radically different experiences that preposterously masquerade for each other. In other words, the mind has all kinds of ideas and has no proprioception of itself. In other words, it's very, very hard to, although it is possible, I think, since thinking is a thing. So since it's a thing, it's possible to have some, I suppose, if you're really practicing deeply, you can, your samadhi can be deep enough so that you can see a thought breach the cervix of the womb of the Buddha. You can visit by going upstream and shining the light within, walking carefully and steadfastly upstream, upstream, upstream. You can come to the place, but you got to really to practice this way, so it's really clear and not a mystification of experience or a projection of your thought. You have to pull your mighty bow back. You have to pull the bow back and hold it back and explore with that kind of vigor and enthusiasm. And anyway, you can see a thought born, but most of the time, I think my experience and your experiences is that we are, it's very, very hard to tell the difference between concept and reality. And we protect, of course, our concepts and our thinking as if, when they are challenged, as if it were life-threatening. It feels like it is someone is invading us. If the, you know, they say sticks and stones can break your bones, but words can't hurt you, actually. Au contraire, words, we have to be, as human beings, extraordinarily careful with our speech, because although from one perspective words have no self-nature, from another it's, we need to be careful. But anyway, the point being that the mind, David gave a very beautiful and touching talk this morning. Most of us were here. And the nice thing about his presence when he was sharing this thing that caught me, although the whole talk was really quite extraordinary, but what caught me was this little phrase from that the mind, from Bohm, who was a friend, disciple, wayfarer like us, friend of Krishnamurti's, and as you know, a great, physicist, great mind, just truly a wonderful mind. I read some of his books. I don't understand physics, but I have enjoyed his book on inquiry and on dialogue process, which is really wonderful Dharma book. But clearly the mind we have, if we personify this activity and think of our the caretakers of our life, we make models of people and relationship that are held very, very deeply and powerfully. I just say this as one way into this. It doesn't have to be about human relationships, it could be about all kinds of things, but it's a nice way for understanding. We make models, composite models in our mind, images and models that are created very, very early when we are very ripe and open and vulnerable. And these are composites of our primary caretakers, and then we project those composites. The mind has an image, clearly. This is especially now at our age, we see this so clearly. And there are certain fundamental human needs that we all have as human beings, not needs in the small-minded sense, but openings into the Dharma world and vulnerable, or mouths, or Dharma mouths, like little baby birds. And when food is put in the mouth in a guileless and wholesome way, and there's a genuine meeting and connection, then this baby bodhisattva is nourished and begins to grow in vitality. It's a generative thing. When food enters, you find the mouth of this bird and you pop a little insect inside it. Then this bird grows strong, and as its needs are met through the apertures of its self, of the self, the way in which the self feeds itself, then it grows strong and it trusts in this possibility for connection and intimacy. And it grows and it goes flying about its bird world, and it will inherently and instinctively seek out another bird that is engaged in the same activity, because it's wisdom. Its wisdom functions, our wisdom functions impeccably and wonderfully all the time. So it seeks, and then it seeks out, and it replicates itself. Cause and effect is very clear, and life seeks to, it's a generative process, self-generative, self-fulfilling samadhi on all levels, we are taught anyway. So it recreates itself. But of course, for those of us whose fundamental needs were fed something that was not nourishing, and there is some great, great longing of the heart to know itself, or to be met, or to be seen, and I mean this spiritually as well as psychologically, then because that is objectified in the mind, the image of this, then that being goes out searching for someone who will punish it. They're trying to address the fundamental place of woundedness or disorder, and it will find that person who is most uniquely suited to not help them. But because it unerringly from both sides finds a person, it projects the image. This is what David was saying. I'm approaching it from a little bit more cognitive side, but it's a very interesting thing. because it projects that image, and because the other person is, of course, seeking, karmically seeking, in this unconscious way in which we find ourselves in situations that are both our greatest torment and our greatest opportunity for self-realization, it finds another who's doing the same thing. And they come together pursuing the projection of their own mind. Obviously, we do this all the time, right? And that projection is a composite of their karma or their experience. And so when something starts to match up, like this bird, they unerringly are drawn towards it. I can't live without you. And similarly, and so there is this matchup, right? And what is required of these two beings is that in order for them to make it together, each one has to do what they most don't want to do to make it. They have to enter into the imperative land, the land of the imperative that says, if you do that, like these little kids playing, one of them says, if you do that one more time, I'm going to run away from you. Right, that's the imperative land. And they have to melt themselves down in that and then find that they're offering themselves to the other and the other doing what they most want to do for themselves is exactly the offering for the other, and some possibility is born out of something, as we said earlier, of the Mumonkan, of the Hekigan Roku, the blue cliff, the iron wall, the glass mountain. Something is born. And that something that is born is called true love. And that true love comes out of a fissure in a sheer rock wall. But that experience of the experience of zanmai, touching, to make contact, to receive, and then to start to convey and act in service of what it is that you found by your own liveliness of and juiciness of your own experience, it starts to redirect it starts to redirect and retrain our radar, so that then in our lives what we're most interested in is not so much the content, good or bad. This is a fearsome teaching, because the teaching is that loss is a much a way into the heartland of true love as fulfillment. But what we're really interested in is, since we've seen this, that the content of wisdom is samadhi and its expression is something filled with the possibility of love. In other words, here we go. We stop, we appreciate, we take action. Same, the three bodies. So we stop with this wherever we are in our koan study. It doesn't have to be bad. It might be beautiful, or it might be no problem whatsoever. But even in no problem, there are still worlds within worlds within worlds of that no problemness that make that no problemness more of a no problem than you ever dreamed of. you see, it's the same. And the same deflection takes place. So then what happens in this koan study, that this is what we're singing about in this koan, in these books, is this potential and possibility for the self to know itself. Then what happens when that jijuyu zanmai takes place, what we call this self-realization, on some level. And of course it's not outside our everyday life, but it is outside our everyday life. You know, if it weren't outside our everyday life, not in the experiential sense, I don't mean in the intrinsic sense, then Zen would have died out long ago. It would have just been another day at the office. Oh yeah, everyday life, oh yeah. But that's not the case. The fact of the matter is that what we're doing, people have done for thousands of years, and they have devoted their, not that I'm saying that we should all run off to the mountains and be, you know, because it's the same there. I ran off to the mountains, and I will be the first to report my miserable self came along with me, and there I am in my cabin with myself again. But you see what we're working with. So then, when we stop, the three bodies of practice, self-realization, and practice realization are stopping, appreciating, and conveying. In other words, we stop, we come to appreciate something in a deeper way, and then we convey our appreciation of what it is that we met as we sit on the cushion. Our Zazen lights up, at least sometimes, and we say, man, this is for real. This is really serious business. And this I have the possibility to transform my life. And I have the possibility to have more love and understanding in my life, a little bit. And it really matters. And it really matters that I experiment and work in a wholehearted and loving and determined way on this cushion, because you will go and meet your spouse or meet your library or meet your whatever it is, and they're going to be, most of them, determined to stop you from doing this. And they will do everything they can on one level to induct you into the world of their own loneliness. So we are pioneers in one way and intrepid explorers. And of course, that's just one angle. But anyway, back to the stopping, appreciating, and conveying as one thing. Then we come back and we start to set our sights for, having had this moment of experience that is true, not compared to false, but true because it is absolutely true in your own experience, and no one can take it away from you, or no one can say, well, I don't think so, or I don't see it that way. I mean, it's not about that, is it? It's about something else, you know. It's about something much more intimate, much more meaningful, much more beautiful. And there's no need to convince or browbeat or argue with someone. You just see that they don't know in that case. Or anyway. So, but point I want to keep beating you over the head with is that when you get the fundamental teaching and process of Zen, at whatever level, this transformative, self-fulfilling samadhi or self-study, or however we want to talk about it, and you feel the aliveness and the beauty and the juiciness of it, and wonder and mystery, then you start to say, all right, now what I'm going to do in my life is more and more set sail towards life, not word and defense and explanation and rationalization. So someone comes into your life and you have practiced this, and they say, you know, those people who give you the body cringe, you know, people who wilt you or who give you the look, or who, you know, or just, or maybe they don't even consciously give you the look, you give yourself the look in the form of them, and it all starts up. But then what we're looking for, and this is incredibly interesting and transformative, we're not looking for the meaning. We're not trying to engage them and butt heads with them. We're looking for the liveliness of where they're coming from. Because the liveliness of where they're coming from is their heartland. And their expression is their strategy to fill the need that that liveliness is presenting. And their strategy, more often than not, is really wacky and weird. But if we start to see that what this game of life in the moment of all worlds is about aliveness, then we can start to appreciate the aliveness of their anger or their shame or their vituperousness or their denial or their crabbiness or their lecturingness or their, you know, all of the stuff that we do as well. But we can start to appreciate it in a different way. And also we come back then to the cushion saying, this, you know, I am now, this experimentation that I'm doing with myself, I am now I'm a secret agent in my own life, and I'm a mad scientist in my laboratory in service of love and in service of understanding. And then your Zazen will be inspired. And you will then convey your inspiration by, in some way, shape, or form, however modest, marching out into this beleaguered and broken world and share a drop of shining water on the forest fire.